I look on you all and your professor here, Professor Lochner, as really luminaries in the realm of exploring new areas. I am grateful to be able to play with a topic that I find both intriguing to me, and I have a lot of questions. I have a lot more questions now as a consequence of being able to pursue this matter with you all. I hope that we might have time for discussion. I'm going to try to keep myself safely within limits so that we can discuss much. What I intend to do with this is two things. First, very briefly, to indicate why this very famous text, easily the most famous text of Richard Wilhelm's translation corpus, his German version of the I Ching that's been published in 9 other languages, in numerous editions, why it is problematic, why it is a sinological paradox in a very serious way. And I'm going to spend a lot more time on that tomorrow in the morning seminar. With great detail. But I would like to give you a reason for understanding that, and then maybe I can attract you to join me tomorrow too. And the second one that I'd really like to spend more time on is here, this use of divination. It's not known. It was discovered in work that I've been doing with a team of scholars, 4 of them German scholars, 1 in the U.S., 1 now in Beijing, another in Köln, and a retired a professor who was born in Qingdao, where Richard Wilhelm, or Wei Lixian, as he's known in Chinese, spent his professional career as a missionary, hyphenated missionary scholar, missionary educator. And during that time, he did cast hexagrams, but in the context of being a pastor, a Lutheran Pfarrer, and it's remarkable, I think. No one has ever discussed these texts. I'm showing you them for the first time because when I discovered them, I said, and then I made copies of them and I didn't know what to do with them. I hardly knew how to begin to interpret them. And it's been because of this special request and the urging of a very good younger colleague who is among you that forced me to take up this text again and to try to understand it in greater detail. Oh, good. Oh, I was wondering if I had to do that. These are pictures I think many of you know. This is Wilhelm when he was in Frankfurt and when he'd already taken the professorship there in 1924. And this is a contemporary version of the book. I hope that you all know that this version is not the same as the one that he published in 1924. There are many numerous notes and other things that are not present, and it's good to look up, do the kind of bibliographic history. Here is the grave site, which also has the 8 trigrams beneath it, and so it evokes many things, and some of you may know that his granddaughter has also produced a film recently, and it was played last year, I think, for selected groups. And I've heard it's very good, but I haven't had the chance to see it yet. My concern is about his these certain 3-year period, which is, of course, for German citizens, is a very profound period of instability during World War I. And one that he experienced in some very traumatic ways as well. The historical context that I want to reveal to you will, and here I want to be very, very brief, is to just indicate that he actually did preach in this church, which is a beautiful building. Have some of you been to Qingdao? Yes? It has buildings, German style buildings built in the last decade of the 19th century, and then all the way up through, that many, of course, many were destroyed during World War II. And so it's a remarkable place, and this is an incredible building, and now it's used by the Authorized Church, the Free Self, under the Free Self group, and it's a fantastic building. The auditorium, and the audio technique is phenomenal. But he actually preached there. but he preached using German. He was hired initially as a pastor, a Lutheran pastor, for the German community there. And though he was extremely interested in the Chinese traditions, and one other member of his, an older member, a senior member of his mission, a very famous sinologist named Ernst Faber, was also there. Faber transferred from Shanghai to there, and due to the kinds of conditions they were living in at the time, Faber died of cholera within 6 months. You know, so it was a very difficult kind of situation to be in. But then this Pachgebiet, or this leased territory from the Qing dynasty, remained in German hands until 1940. And as you know, the period we're dealing with is after that. So there's some transitions here that are major that we need to see. This is an image here of what the town looked like, you know, to some degree. It's an actual photograph. And so it's quite remarkable of that period and of the state of the character, the cultural status of the place. He began his series, a very famous series of German translations with the Dietrichsverlag, the so-called Gelbe Reihe, you know, which I've always wondered about. You know, there's a kind of little racist undertone in that, and it's just this very strange thing, you know, that this had come out. But nonetheless, in 1910, he produced Gespräche, you know, and what James Lake called the Analects, and from that time on, he had intended to produce something up to 12 to 15 different texts. And he worked at them in manuscript form. We do have them in his Nachlass, which is available in over 200 boxes now in the Bayerische Akademie der Wissenschaft. So if you want to go, it's there, it's available. And I found the text that I'm going to introduce to you today there. He was, of course, like many others who were overseas and who were German citizens, he was facing the problems of World War I. And in the 1st of August, Japan declared war against Germany. And since Qingdao was in German possession at that time, it became vulnerable. And so he and his family made a very quick talk about prognostications. You know? I mean, there are some things. What is a real possibility we were talking about? You know, when Japan declares war, you know, on Germany, what are you going to do? You know, he had his wife, four sons. The eldest was 13. The youngest was 23 months at that time. You know, they determined, well, we'll split up. His wife, Salome, and the four sons traveled into other parts of China, which were not, so that they were not vulnerable to attacks. And he himself shifted from being a member of the mission group, because there were other members who did choose to fight alongside the German soldiers as a defensive force, and later they were all taken captive and taken to Japan and spent years in Japanese prisons. Yeah. He chose to align himself to the International Red Cross and so became their official representative. Even though he had all of that history up to that point in Qingdao, he was theirs, and so he was neutral, and that was a position that he and his Schwiegervater, Christoph Blumhardt, they sought to maintain neutrality in terms of their interrelationships between warring states. And as a consequence, he was able to survive what became a very messy situation. What will that get? On August 25th, the first naval bombardments began, Japanese Navy bombarding Qingdao. And he remained there and wrote a journal of it, which is still available. I have the title elsewhere. It's Aus Qingdao's da-da-da-da-da, and basically for 6 weeks they were under bombardment and were successful until the last week, when Marines finally, Japanese Marines landed, and then they were overwhelmed numerically. And so he documented all that went on. It was published back in Germany in this area. And so It documented the details of the trauma that was there and how he even began to adjust. Now, of course, I don't want to say naturally, because I don't see war as necessarily being something obvious, but it is certainly traumatic. And it destroyed his ability to maintain the kind of translation series that he had hoped for. We do have elements already by 1914. We have one small version of his Yi Jing, and then went to the Shangshu and even played with parts of the Shijing. But these texts never got out. You know, he was able to produce a Zhuangzi that was not the full Zhuangzi. Some of you may know this. You know, the last seven chapters are missing. You know, we need to be self-conscious of these simply to be able to say, well, who's going to do it? Who's the next German translator of Zhuangzi? You know, we certainly need that, because we haven't yet got a full version in that language. But it was due to the kinds of political problems that we're addressing. And he served essentially not only as a German, Japanese mediator, but he was mediating between Chinese and Japanese authorities, and also between German and Chinese people. It was really a complex matter. He had gained the trust of Japanese authorities enough that he was able to reassert his position as a Lutheran pastor to those who remained. And this has something to do with the text that we're going to see, because those who remained were primarily women and children of the prisoners of war. So you have a very awkward kind of setting where he served not only as a pastor, but also an educator. He was the music director as well. He did numbers of things, to simply maintain some sense of cultural identity in the midst of a very complicated and traumatic, period of time. Now, in this, he began already by 1913 to work with a key traditional Chinese scholar, a person from the Hanting Academy named Lao Naixian. Not Lao Naixian, I won't deal with all the details of that, but he did produce in 1914, as I mentioned, his first rendering of the divination text of the I Ching. And we have that in manuscript form, but it was very elementary. Didn't have anything to do with any of the appendices or any of the extra details that were there. So that when we look at this text, it comes in 1924, many years later. What is intriguing here is that if you compare, the L is James Legge's, which was produced in 1882 as part of the series, his six volumes in the series of the Sacred Books of the East. Legge's text is first the I Ching with the divination text and then the 10 appendices in seven, because several of the appendices are upper, lower, or first and second parts, and so you put them together. And so if you read Legge's text, even though it's a complicated and rather woody translation, you can follow the standard Chinese text and put Legge's text next to it, and you can actually discover what is going on in the translation process. He follows the canonical order, and he gives us a reasonable rendering. Wilhelm does not do so, and that's surprising for many, unless you've tried to look at the text. What he did here, first of all, he was the first. Notice I say book one, and that's why this is not necessarily easy. They don't indicate this is the first book. There are three. And in book one, he included within it the images that come from the second appendix. So he was moving the text and creating what he hoped would be something more understandable for those that are not used to the original text. He also, if you read the text and you see how it's presented, unfortunately, again, not necessarily so clearly, but taking any page, and I want to just use one example. This is an example of the kind of text that you have in book one. But then you see, you have this statement with certain kind of description. You have here das Urteil and das Bild, but you have all this other text, and which is the canonical text and which is the commentary, you can't discern. Have you all seen this? No, I can just pass it out. It's really problematic. So if you take this, and when I was in Bonn, you know, with this very good friend, Wolfgang Kubin, you know, who's a diligent scholar and a very intense person to work with, you know, he told me, yes, one time I said, I'm going to get through the I Ching. And he took Wilhelm's I Ching and put it down and took the text, and he worked for 2 hours to figure out where in the world did he go after the first page. You know, he couldn't find out where it was. Because in fact he was not making any clarity whatsoever between the canonical text, commentaries, his own impositions. You know, this becomes really problematic. Now this is just an example of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And for those of you to get book two, there's how it's all messy. He uses it from three different appendices. Don't look too closely. You have to come tomorrow. And book three. I could spend the whole time talking about this because I published this in 2005 in Chinese in the 中国文职研究所的中央书院的那边的中央院中的。 But that was in the Academia Sinica, the newsletter of the Chinese literature, the Institute of Chinese Literature and Philosophy, and they were very happy about that. But I've never gotten the English version out, so those of you who come get to see the English version. Mm-hmm. And it does, I've only put five here, but it does include all 64 of the extracts. Mm-hmm. What I want to do, though, is this, okay? And this has never been seen before. Your eyes, your eyes are given special privileges. I have not published about this before. I have been debating a lot within my own mind. But allow me now to do just kind of what I would call grammatological description, okay? I want you to understand what we're looking at, okay? This is a two-part text, okay? This is the middle of the text. You flip it over, and it was a very nice leather-bound, very nice ornate piece with gilded edges. Mm-hmm. About 60 pages or 30 openings, something like that. He wear it here. Mm-hmm. And it had on the first page 1919. I just had that date, but it dealt obviously with things before and afterwards. This is the fifth page of that document. And as you can see here, it's talking about des Reiches Gottes und Erden and so on. It was his pastoral notebook. He had numerous calendar dates, festival dates. He kept names, and as you can see here, he was, I don't know what he was doing with Luther and Bismarck, Kant and Schopenhauer. Is Bismarck like Schopenhauer? Spinoza and Carlyle. I don't know what kind of comparison he's doing, but he had some kind of notes that he was putting down, and he was thinking, and he would write them down. He had notes about people he was counseling and others. And then you have on the other side this strange thing, and it appears on the fifth page. And we have no date whatsoever, and if you do the sniffy little imagery that you can do now, I can give you that side of the page. And what you have here, those of you that are the experts in I Ching, I don't have to say this, right? For those like me that are really ignorant, we have to figure out what this is. Here he has names, so that these are actually abbreviations of names. M is May for Salome, his wife. We know this by the other means that you'll see. And then these are Frau such as, because, and all of them are Frau. Why? Because they're, all of their husbands were in prison, and they were facing, great problems. They'd already had their husbands away for at least 3 to 4 years. There is no date here. We don't know when he did this. But we know there are two other sequences that are more clear, and I'll show you those in just a moment. What you see here too, some of you will recognize, but if you'll permit me, I'll be very basic, and pardon me if I'm boring. I don't intend to be that way, but sometimes you have to deal with things like this. The straight line is the yang, the broken line is the yin, and where you have marks like this, this means that when he cast the hexagram, which was, he was using stocks most likely, but we don't have any record about how he did it, we can assume it. You know, and there are standard ways in which you do this, where he put that, in this case, where he put the circle, it meant that that is a moving line. So that when you cast the hexagram, you have an initial hexagram that indicates the current situation, and then you transform the lines to the alternative, where yin becomes a yang, or a yang becomes a yin, and it creates another hexagram. And that's the moving hexagram. That's the direction of the change or the transformation that will occur. So that here, because it was the first time that he did it, what we have here in this form, he now goes down here. See, this is the same person, his wife, Mei, and then he puts the numbers here. So it's from hexagram number 20 to hexagram 37. And if you have the 64, you can go through and determine them. And then you get a direction, you know, on how he's done. And here we have eight clear persons. Any of you who can read this, that, I'd be very glad to know what you see. I'm still not sure who they refer to or what they refer to, but they are also hexagrams, so they're cast. I'll come back to these in a moment, so that we can. I want first to introduce you to the materials. This is the first, and there are three recordings. The next two are sequences. Okay? And this sequence is very clearly identified on Sylvester of 1918, and on New Year's Day, 1919, he cast, in this case, 14 gua. And he started, intriguingly, always with Allgemein. This is one thing that seems to be consistent in these two sequences. So he's looking at the general situation. And I'm going to take this up here later on. But then we see who Frau O was and Frau K and so on, you know, because we have him now writing them out. What's interesting is this, and we'll talk about that later on, you know, and going on. So what he was doing, if you compare the lists, there is no shared order. There is no one person that always is first. It is done according to his consciousness at the time. If you read something like Georg Zimmer's new translation in the introduction, he talks about the practice of divination. He says, yeah, you have to go through this process. It takes about 30 minutes per hexagram. So he's spending about one half of his day. Each day, something like 4 to 6 hours. And he's concerned about certain people. And whoever comes up in his mind, he will write it out. And he presents it and moves accordingly. So that through the whole, you know, in some cases, as we see, we'll come back here to talk about this, he only has one. Why is it only one? You know, why aren't there moving hexagrams? Well, what's going on here? You know, we want to know. And you see he's using now a little bit of different symbols, you know? He has some variety that he's developing. And then here, I'm sorry, my Xeroxing skills were not good, but that says erste, you know, 1990, you know? And occasionally he'll add a few little notes here, and ends with this one. What's interesting too, you know, just from a synological point of view, is how he, you know, transliterates the names of some of these guar. Because what we get in 1924 is sometimes different. You can also see he's in a process of learning. But he's doing this not because he's trying to do an academic discipline. He is performing a pastoral duty. This is very interesting. And this is the final problem I want to deal with interpretively is precisely that. What is this pastoral duty? How in the world can you have someone who is a Lutheran pastor using the I Ching, you know, to do what? You know, what's going on here? Now, that's the first sequence. That occurs on pages 21 through 26. So you really have quite a bit of other stuff in between. You know, you have notes about his sermons, about how he's planning out different events and other things of his sort. And then, pow, 21 through 26. You know? And when I saw this, I got excited. You know? But that wasn't the last of it. Then I kept going through it, and sure enough, on pages 48 to 53, I came up with a second sequence. And it started again with Allgemein, and here you see X and O. Now X means the Yang turns to Yin, and here O should mean the Yin turns to Yang. So he's getting a little bit more sophisticated, more precise in what he's doing. But, and now we have also names, as before, with the numbers of the hexagram, no transliteration. Sometimes he gives it, but you know, we have not only Frau, but Westchester. There was a hospital, that was there, and there were also members of the Blumhardt family that were with him, and other things at this in the time before, and some remained. There's just a number of issues, but it goes through the whole process. 3 to 4 sets of hexagrams cast, and this time 18 persons. So my estimate is that he spent a full working day, you know, probably 8 to 9 hours per day to render these and to assess. And here you see, and once more, okay, it's a little bit of an interesting thing, one as opposed to others. Once again here, another one, and this. Okay. Now, what we have here is a Christian act of pastoral discipline. And I want to first describe. So I first will not try to so much interpret, you know, what I'm saying. Of course I'm doing that too. But I want to be descriptive so that you can observe with me what in the I Ching is guan, you know, that you look carefully with me at these. Because I seriously do have other problems, and I hope you can answer my problems for me. Yeah. But there are things that I have discovered, and I would like to be able to share these with you as well. What I intend to do here is first to deal with those allgemein, the two allgemein settings, because I find them intriguing, you know, and it indicates something about what was occurring in Wilhelm's own consciousness and why later on when he met Carl Jung and started sharing these matters in 1921, Jung got very, very excited about this and talked about synchronicity and all kinds of stuff, you know, because Wilhelm was sharing from his experiences. He had done this at least 3 times, very seriously, in the midst of the changes of World War I and the devastating, you know, realities that he had to deal with in the congregation of people that he was concerned for. The first hexagram, you know, the first changes that we have, and here, if you'll allow me, I'm going to twist your minds a bit. Oh, it's so fast, I know. Yeah, okay, good, okay. So it's this one, okay? What we have here, you notice, is 41, and then you have one line that shifts to 27, okay? December 31st, 1918. What was going on at that time? Okay. Do you have any imagination there that you can draw up, you know, any historical sense? I mean, the war is still on, but things are kind of winding down, you know, and it's not easy. And so he gives that there. Oh, watch your eyes. Oh, there we go. Okay, good. Now, so this is, I give you the term that he uses in German in the 1924 edition. But those of us who know the character Sun, you know that this is used for what is not just a decline, you know, but it can be disastrous, you know, loss and many other things. And so even the name itself smacks of a very difficult situation. But when you go to read the judgment and the image, which he included there, you read something that's quite different. It says that the cultivated man, who he deals with, this is Junzi, and yes, please look it up. I've actually got notes on it, but I have my paper here, and so maybe this can be passed on to those that are interested. But he says, De Eldle, the person who is the cultivated man, the noble person, you know, is one, because of this decline, because of this imminent trouble, the person is going to be very cautious and persistent, awaiting for the right time to come. Now, what's intriguing is this shift on the fifth line. Normally, when you read the line judgments, so you have a judgment of the whole hexagram, the six lines, as a unit, as an image, and you have an image that divides the six lines into two trigrams, and it will say, oh, this is, in this case, this is the mountain above the ocean. And that means the mountain sinking. The ocean water cannot hold it. And so there's problems. It's unstable. It's possibly disastrous. But then you can go to each line, and each line will say, if the line is a 5 or a 7 or a 9, then you have a judgment. And I won't get into the technicalities of that, but let me just say that very intriguingly, in the shift, when you shift the fifth line to 27, which is, yes, the corner of the mouth, what is this Mundwinkel, what is this? And the sense of nurturing, you have something shifting from something nearly disastrous to something that's beginning to move toward correction, and possible, constructive developments. The fifth line has an addition. It says, yes, the nobleman remains very, very self-conscious, and you do not cross over great waters. So what is Wilhelm and others thinking? Oh, we're not going to leave this year. We're not going on the boat back to Germany. And they didn't. It's very intriguing. So the special indications there were quite remarkable for him and for his community. Of course, he was asking many other things. He was asking about what about the husbands, how are we going to deal with various different problems with their children, and so on and so on. But that's the first. Now the second one changes quite distinctively. When he dealt with the general situation, which was the first act he did in each of these two longer sequences, the first one that he gets is this one, it's Eindrückung, or Eindrückung der Werbung. And so he is now self-conscious that there is some kind of new influence that's coming. And at the end of 1919, already peace talks were underway. 1920, there were going to be repatriations and others. And intriguingly, in this one, for reasons, influences here, is very strange because that particular hexagram, if you look at it, it talks about not only the positive influences that are going to occur, but also that it's a very good time to get married, and uses it in terms of it's good to take a young maiden at that time. And that's a strange, but also a symbolic gesture of new life. New opportunity. And for a person who had four sons, that may be very important. You kind of figure the oldest son is so good, 18, 19, somewhat young, but they've gone through war and there are things to consider. In this one, you have two lines. I better go back. I've gone back all too far. Here, me. Okay, get back here. Excuse me. How do I do that?
I see his.
It's that one. Yes. Nope, it's not. It's the next one. Excuse me. I didn't know how quite to do that technologically, so I'm sorry for the blinding eyes there. But as you see, there are two changes, and they are changes of different order. one is going from yang line to yin, and the other one is going from the yin line to yang. And that ends up creating something very interesting, because you move, what it essentially does, when you change those two lines, you come to the next hua.
Yeah, intriguing.
One of the lines, the fifth line that changes, refers to a kind of internal change that is not relevant. So he had to cancel it. It didn't matter. Really. It helped to form the moving hexagram, but it wasn't significant. Mm-hmm. The other one, though, the second line, when you take the second line of hexagram 31 and you move it, you change it to a yin, that one is significant. Because it says there, once more, it emphasizes, the person who is a cultivated man is going the right direction. He must be persistent and will not change his direction. Something new, something decisive was about. And what happened was the war treaties were solved. They were settled in East Asia. They came later. Well, some of you know that that happened. The fate of Qingdao and Korea and many other things were still in the balance, but there were now major concerns that were being resolved, and some of the husbands who had been in prison for as much as 5 years were being now returned to Qingdao, and then with their families were returning to Germany. Those that survived, and most of them did, but not all. So you have something very, very significant here that is, in terms of the general situation, was profound and revealing. It was, for Wilhelm, something remarkable. Now, he did share this with Carl Jung in 1921. He gave a talk on these experiences. I don't know at all that he showed them what I've just showed you. I don't think he did, because they didn't have PPTs and other things like that, but he did tell about his experiences. And Jung was profoundly impressed. But what was behind some of these is significant. And here, what I want to focus on is the second one. The first one is a little bit messy, if I could just call it that way. Okay? Put it very, very briefly and far too coarsely, probably. Richard Wilhelm's father-in-law had a situation where his wife became a paraplegic, and under conditions that were apparently communicated, he took on a kind of second wife, a concubine, essentially, under those conditions until she died. That was very unusual for a Lutheran pastor. It's highly problematic. But the family knew about it, and they adjusted. Wilhelm, having to have a congregation of women and children, faced a similar situation, and the person that was involved was the person least of five. That has been hidden from view because some of the materials have been destroyed. They were that sensitive. And other things have been found through our research, that comes. What is intriguing about all of this is this, which I'll show you.
That's a long way. It's already there.
Now, this is the one you see least, right? Mm-hmm. This is the only one where we have a fourth gua. And the gua, notice, is in, hexagram, Chinese came up. The hexagram is in parentheses, right? Why? Well, those who know the trigrams, the hexagram, this is the qian, this is the quan, right? This is heaven and earth, heaven above earth, male above female, and so on. And it is, when you go to find it, it's a hexagram number 4, and it is a hexagram that says, do not go that direction. My hunch, here I'm interpreting very much. My hunch is, he was saying, in my heart, before God and the others, I know I shouldn't do this. This is what I expect. But when he went through and did these, he got a different message. And when you compare that with the message that he also did when he did his hexagrams for his wife, it was completely the opposite direction. Go and get married. Go and chase the mate. Really incredible. We didn't know that, and I didn't know that until I started preparing this paper this time, that it really makes a difference in terms of what happened in Richard Wilhelm's later life. Lise Barr became his personal secretary. She went with him without his family to Beijing in 1922. 1922 journal has been, you know, disappeared because he was writing her more often than others and so on and so on. But ultimately things were resolved. He went back to Salome and the four sons, and there was resolution. Lise Barr later went on to be his secretary and then to marry after he passed away. And so there's an incredible kind of situation in the context of a pastoral situation. But I'm interested here, and the last thing I want to do with is this. Can there be any use of divination within the context of a Christian worldview? Is it possible to have a sinification of Christianity where divination would be used within not just a theistic context, but within a Trinitarian theistic context? That's a mental game for you, huh? And here, I don't know if some of you are aware. Some of you, I'm sure, are. But allow me to just explore this. First of all, when you go to the passage in, Apostelsgeschichte in German? Yeah. What in English is called Acts, the Acts of the Apostles. The first chapter, verses 20 through 26, there is an act of divination. Lots are cast because Judas Iscariot, betrays the Redeemer. He then is terribly traumatized. He rejects his act. He sees it as evil. He is essentially rejected on all sides, and so he goes out and hangs himself. He dies as a person deeply distressed. As a consequence, in this passage you will see first the Apostle Peter cites prophecies about that happening from the Hebrew Scriptures. Then he says, we need to have someone to replace this, and they all agree, and says, okay, what are the conditions? So they set out rational conditions. They must have been with Yeshua and the other disciples for the whole ministry, and they came up with two people. Okay. Then they said, okay, what do we do now? So then they prayed. They said, Lord Yahweh, you know all men's hearts. Show us which one should go. And then they cast lots. And the person that was chosen was Matthias, as opposed to the other who was named Joseph. Now, when you go to the Union Bible translation, which is the 1919 version, right that year, that it was done. So I'm sure that Wilhelm was not aware, maybe, of this, but though he may have seen a version of it. The term that's used for casting lots is Yao Qian, which is the same word you use for using the stocks to determine the hexagrams for each individual. Exactly the same words. And so a Chinese Christian would read those and say, oh, I can do that. If I have all of these other kind of conditions that are there. Now, Wilhelm was in a context of abject distress. He was responsible as a pastor for something like 50 persons who were basically left stranded. Their lives were stranded for 5 years, in between warlike conditions. And he was maintaining their existence and trying to make it meaningful. He didn't understand. He couldn't prognosticate. He couldn't know for certain what the future would hold. He had no means. But my sense is that he certainly prayed and that he certainly was concerned for the people in his in various different concerns too, as I've suggested. But he was very concerned for all the people that were there. Who comes first, who comes last? I think there are differences, and I've indicated that the very last one was particularly significant for his own life and for problematic situations that he was struggling with very much. Could you have a wrong divination? Yes, that's why he canceled out some. If divinations come up and they are not relevant, you can cancel them and reapproach them with the same kind of concern, with the same kind of sincerity, and seek until you find what you know should be relevant. So there are ways that occurs. But here we have something that Max Weber, the sociologist of religion, didn't anticipate. He divided religions into ideal religious types, and he put the Confucian or Wu traditions in opposition to the prophetic traditions that you have in the Christian tradition. Wilhelm lived a synthesis. Carl Jung said, no, that's impossible. Jung thought that this would be a crisis for anyone. He even claimed in part that the reason Wilhelm died early was not just because of physical disease, but because he was psychologically in such strain because he had adopted, he'd become what we would now call a hybrid personality, maybe in sociological terms. In fact, syntheses occur regularly. And I disagree with Max Weber, and I've done so publicly in print, on saying why theoretically he's wrong, and historically he's wrong. We have very strong forms of synification of Christianity even to this day, some more radical than others. But I do not see his, at this stage of his life, now later on he did things very, very differently. He left Orthodox Christianity completely. He rejected the form of Lutheran Christianity that had supported World War I. He saw it as an act that was necessary for his own spiritual conscience. It's very interesting. He still honored Jesus, but not the Jesus of Orthodox Christianity. And he took on the position of a Wu, of an Edle, of a nobleman, and he died in that capacity. But in this stage, I would say, no, what he did was a genuine act of a pastoral concern for people living in a Chinese world in which they were caught in a great dilemma, and he was searching for answers. I hope your questions will help me search for more answers too. Thank you.